All right, welcome back. So it's been said in Buddhist cosmology that the human birth is the best birth because it has the right mixture of suffering and also the right mixture of ease. And I think emotions, this is a nice way to look at that. And emotions can be so devastating, so overwhelming. They can also be such a rich part of being alive. And also can be a source of insight, a way of learning to delve into the Dharma, to understand the nature of self, the nature of separation. And so I like to explore emotions from that lens. Now, just as a kind of an overview with emotions, that this talk is really meant to focus on emotions that we can have some purchase of investigation into. So as many times emotions are overwhelming, especially if they're really tied to a life's event, a difficult experience. If they're tied to trauma, they often are need a different way of meeting and working with them. The Dharma is something that needs to adapt to what's present for you. So some of this may not resonate or may not be the right, really not the right approach if you're dealing with a lot of very difficult emotions. That's more what the first talk was pointing toward, is how to find that sense of stability, that sense of spaciousness, even to some degree in the midst of a gripping emotion. Now, when emotions, though, when we can find that gateway into an investigation around them, and sometimes, interestingly enough, that gateway can be reveal itself even in the midst of very intense emotions. Just something, for me, when that's happened, it's like any other strategy just doesn't work. I try doing this, I try doing that, I try solving it, I try arguing with it, I try ranting and crying, and finally the suffering is so much, I finally relax into it. So that sometimes is what arises for us, and that's sometimes the gift of those intensities, intense times. Now, on the other hand, we can look at emotions when they're just kind of the run-of-the-mill, kind of normal grittiness, the kind of rub, the difficulty that we have. We can look at emotions, again, from this standpoint, in two ways. We can relate to an emotion in a way that generates and maintains and kind of cultivates this sense of me. Now, we literally say that, I am so angry, I am so upset. We're using the emotion as a way to define us. And it feels like the emotion is really creating, you know, who I am. In a lot of ways, it is. You know, thinking back to last year's exploration of dependent origination, emotions are a very concrete and visceral way of experiencing that cycle of dependent origination, from contact to vedana to craving, clinging, becoming, and birth. That's what it feels like when you get really triggered emotionally. It's that's the felt sense you've taken birth into someone who's really upset, someone who's really happy and excited, someone who's very fearful, someone who is very sad. There's that birth that arises in relationship to that. So as Dogen said, to study the Buddha way is to study the self. Okay? To study the Buddha way is to study the self. And so this is this first aspect, is when the self is being really maintained and formed around this emotion. It's like this little crystal, little, like, I think if you take, if the weather is right, you drop a little bit of sand into something, a little dust even, that can create a lot of ice crystals. Doesn't that sound right? Nice right now in this 100, over 100 degree weather, having those ice crystals just form. It's like that, it's almost magical when you see that. Okay, so that's the magicalness of how the sense of self is formed. There's that little dust, bit of dust, and we form a whole sense of self around it. So to study the Buddha way is to study the self. And then to study the self is to forget the self. Okay, that is this other aspect, how the self can really, or emotions can really be free of the sense of self. We can actually use the midst of being caught in emotion and that self-defining quality to it, to see through that, to actually see the emptiness of it. And emotions can flow through us really free of that self-referencing. So these two ways of balancing that, and just to finish Dogen's famous quote, to study the Buddha way is to study the self. To study the self is to forget the self. To forget the self is to be actualized by myriad things. When actualized by myriad things, your body and mind, as well as the bodies and minds of others, drop away. No trace of enlightenment remains. And this no trace continues endlessly. Okay, so this is a very deep and profound statement and shows the potentiality of our practice. But sometimes emotions come up and we learn to study the self, and what we learn to do is to find some place of stability in the midst of this crisis that we're dealing with. Sometimes that's the skills of psychological work, of boundaries, of taking care of ourselves, of how the choices we make in our lives. And sometimes those studying that self, we start to question the validity, or not so much the validity, but the solidity of that self. And sometimes we can see through that to see the emptiness beyond that. So emotions that define us, that create that sense of me. How do we practice with that? How do we find a way of finding a gateway through that? A big part of this, a way to kind of, it's almost like we need to cool down that momentum enough to observe it. The ways that don't cool it down, that really amp it up, is when we maintain our projections outward. We continue to project the cause of our emotion, the blame of it, the reason of it, on other people and other situations. Yes, of course, you know, there's people's actions and practice. People do unskillful things. So it's not to negate that. It's not to negate having clear boundaries and having those perhaps difficult conversations as we learn to navigate our relationships in the world. And yet, from the moment's perspective of just how do we relate to it in this very moment, at this very moment we're creating this sense of self, it's extremely helpful to be able to drop the projection outward, the blame outward. In other words, to take full responsibility that I'm having this experience. If we don't, I mean, I think we all know this, how many hours, and if I add them up, days and months have I spent just lost in the, oh, you know, I'm going to just say that to that person next time I say them. Just that ruminating over and over and over again. It's endless. I think we all know this. You know? So learning how to, at least for the moment, drop that sense of projection to say, okay, this is my emotion. I'm feeling that. Where is it felt as a body experience? Again, I'm talking about emotions which are more this run of the mill, not talking about emotions that are really coming from a traumatic experience or trauma being re-triggered, or even something that's extremely overwhelming. We have to have enough coolness or balance of that. If it's so overwhelming, this isn't the right approach at this point in time. So how do we work with it in this way, the sense of seeing through that anchoring? And so we're releasing that projection outward, taking full responsibility. Another way I like to work with it for myself, and also when I work with students, is to get a sense of where that sticking point is around the emotion. And usually there's some place in there. You know, there's the overt expression of it, what we're talking about, what we're focused on, the he, what, you know, he said this, she said that, did this. But there's a sticking point. You know, that, and that's often like a sense of belief, a sense of assumption of how I should be, how the world should be. Often think of it as if I took a piece of silk and drew it across another piece of silk, it would slide across without any friction or very little friction. But if I drew that same silk across some rocks, those rocks would kind of snag on that silk. You would feel, okay, there's that pull there and here. And that's what I'm talking about, is where those pulls are, where those little rubs are. And often in it, it is a sense of, I should be this way. I should be different than I am. another way to say it is, how am I not allowing the moment to be just how it is? How am I not allowing myself to be 100% how I am in this moment? Again, we're setting aside the importance of taking of action, of need, of how do we take care of ourselves in navigating the world, setting that aside for the time being, for this moment's investigation. You know, just, it's almost like taking this very personally. How can I work with this? How can I work with this in this moment? So try to find where that rub is, where that sticking point is. And often it's just like something very simple. You know, what am I not allowing? You know, I'm not allowing my anger. I'm not allowing my fear, my sadness. And by simply breathing into that, saying, okay, it's okay that that is here, suddenly the whole thing starts to shift. It's amazing every time this happens, and it happens, you know, more and more the more you get used to doing this. You take the superficial intensity of the emotion and all of the beliefs and thoughts swirling around that, and you simply be still with it. And it's still swirling around. You know, there's all the mind states and all emotions, but there's a part of you that's just observing that, that's not adding to that storm. And we don't add to that storm, we're actually starting to relate to, okay, what's actually here? Let me actually feel that sadness. Let me feel that fear. Let me feel that anger. And when I do that, I can see what the belief is that's connected with that. And often when I do that, there's a deeper emotion or a deeper belief that's revealed. It's interesting when I touch upon that, then the whole thing starts to quiet down. It's like this unseen foundation is seen, and everything starts to settle, at least somewhat. So the emotions that lead to that sense of me, that sense of self, again, it's, we don't want to negate that or fight against it, but actually observe it. And to study the Buddha way is to study the self. How is this sense of self forming? How is it being created moment after moment? How is emotions leading to that creation? Be interested in it. Be curious around it. Even pausing, saying, oh, wow, I'm really upset, and I can feel that sense of me forming in relationship to it. When I do that, it's like it's a visceral sense. It's like a position that I've established of me and the other person, me and the situation. And as Dogen said, to study the self is to forget the self. So this is this other aspect, that when from a dharmic perspective, we can allow emotions to be free of that self-referencing, that self-creation. To start to look more deeply at, you know, that sense of the formless. So what I mean by the formless is something that's not self-referencing, that's not going back to creating a sense of I, of me, of mine, or of you, of yours, and to start to see the emotions just as something that's flowing through us, free of that connection, that relationship to self. Now, we're not self-referencing that way. It's like, it's interesting, emotions can arise, and they can just actually be very powerful, they can be very expansive. I remember being on retreats and sometimes tapping into deeper aspects of sorrow, of sadness, of pain, of fear, of anger, and yet not being self-referenced. And they have this almost this flowing through. They just flow without that connection back to the sense of me. Okay, I'm going to turn off my video for a moment. Except my bandwidth is a little. Okay, I was just checking with my housemates to make sure their computers are down. So is that a little bit better for sound? Yes, no, yes, some thumbs up. A little better. Okay. Internet speed. Okay, we're almost done with this part anyway. So when emotions are not self-reference, it's really getting a taste of that formless nature. how to form, it's like starting to gaze into the emptiness of experience and not be so freaked out by that. To actually say, okay, that emptiness is actually part of me. It's part of all things. And being able to relax into that in some way, sometimes very deeply, sometimes tentatively. But when we relax into it, there's a way that the formless just starts to, our heart starts to wake up around it. And so even something that seems so tied to form, like an emotion, we can actually see it free of that form. And that's when I was talking about 2 weeks ago, about that spaciousness, that sense of ground around emotion. You allow the emotion to be held in a much more spacious container. Like you walk through the landscape, walking through nature, letting emotion just be spread out through the trees, through the sky. It's going to more of this formless relationship to emotion. How emotion is not tied to that sense of me. So as we practice with this, you know, often we first start by noticing how it's self-forming. We acknowledge that, see where those rubs are. And then we can start to relax those rubs. Just by acknowledging them themselves, start to relax our relationship to them. And then we can start to free up that self-referencing to some degree. And the emotion starts to flow freely through us without coming back to that sense of I, that sense of me. So emotions, it's such a vital part of being human. They're really a gift in this way. They both show us how we identify, how we create that sense of me. And they also provide this gateway into the formless, into the sense of emptiness. All right, let's just sit quietly for a few moments, letting those words settle. All right, so for those who are willing, I'd like to invite us into some dyads. Now, if that's you're uncomfortable with that, you're welcome to stay back in the main group, and about 8:30 we'll come back and have some general questions and answers. But I think the dyads can be a lovely way to explore this topic, to see, you know, see it really for ourselves, almost real time. So those who aren't familiar with dyads, who have one other person that you'd just be using to support your practice. They'll simply be asking you a question over and over again in a relaxed way. And each time you hear the question, you let the answer reveal itself. So it's almost a very immediate, fresh, curious way of letting things show up. So often when we try to do this ourselves, we kind of lose interest, or we get distracted, or we run into our own resistance and we kind of back away from that. And the way the dyads work, we do two cycles of 5 minutes. So one person will be asking the first question, which will be, how does emotion define you? Or maybe how does emotion create the sense of you? Whichever version, how does it define you might be a good way of doing it. Doesn't matter if there's an emotion going on right now. You can just reflect in your this day or in the past few days. And just reflect, okay, when I'm angry, how does that define me? And let each time you hear that question, see what arises, say a few sentences, go back to silence, and the questioner will ask the question again. Then after 5 minutes, I'll send a little broadcast note and you can switch roles. And then we'll go to the second question and I'll reveal that one at that time. So two cycles of 5 minutes. Okay, everyone back here, I assume you're happy being here. you can just sit quietly reflecting on that question. How does emotion define me? How does emotion define me? Okay, those back here with me, switching roles. And now the question is, how is emotion free of self? How is emotion free of self? Okay, for 5 minutes. Okay, so let's have a discussion. Let's talk about how emotions both define us, create the sense of me, and also how they release the sense of me. You know, how our emotions, you know, can be free of the self. And hopefully the dyad, you maybe got a real time sense of how that is. So you're welcome to raise your hand or unmute yourself if you'd like to ask a question or share your experience. Okay, Rob, I see you've unmuted yourself.
I didn't have a question. Sorry.
That's all right.
Well, I could talk about what we, Brooke and I talked about in our.
Okay, great. Diet. Go ahead.
Yeah, it was, those are really interesting questions. You know, whether or not, I guess Brooke was talking about a talk that she heard from Brené Brown, you know, that are we emotional, are we at our core emotional beings, the thinking minds or the other way around? And, I guess I thought of it as you're both, but I think at first we're emotional. I mean, mm-hmm. I guess, you know, now that I'm listening, it's like I kind of agree, I guess, with Brené Brown on that one. But, thinking about as babies, you know, the first thing we do is, you know, we cry for our food. We, you know, we get attention, but through our emotions. And I think it's confusing sometimes to know. I think the more I practice, the more I'm being able to separate those, that this is not my identity. Being angry is not my identity, or, you know, but I still notice those ones that are really sticky. And then the other part of it is it a belief, or is it, you know, it's the other word, but is it a belief, or is it something that I'm accept, you know, the other, I think belief is stronger when I believe, for instance, when I believe that, you know, I'm not connected to anybody in the world. Mm. I mean, that happens sometimes and I can be, you know, some, you know, there's this delusion that enters the world, and so that's self, but it's also, yes, a belief that I'm accepting. And anyway.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. That belief, especially like one that I'm separate or I'm isolated from the world or I don't belong. I mean, you can see how powerful of a statement that is. That really orients you in relationship to the world. It creates that sense of separation. You know, it has a lot of juice, has a lot of energy and a lot of pain. But that's a mechanism that we can see, that separation. So sometimes it comes down to what's more important, because there's a sense of autonomy, that sense of power, of authority, of whatever it might be. But that's all kind of the language of separation. If we were dropped separation, you know, we're not so defined. You know, we can't really get behind any opinion, much less our own. And so there's kind of that, it's that interesting piece there. And we all have those edges that, you know, we know we're right, you know, another person's wrong, and we really dig our heels in. And yet that's part of that selfing. So I try to, you know, approach this topic so we don't judge that part when we form that sense of self, but more of it as a way to understand it and just step back. And, you know, when we get really charged by something, just know, step back and say, oh, I can see that sense of self that's there. I can see the whole landscape. I can see its expression. And just to get to know that, because it's usually so unconsciously assumed. It's usually just the way we think things are. Yeah, thank you for sharing that, Cheryl. I like your backdrop there out in your backyard.
It's my air-conditioned backyard. He's actually a little breeze back here.
Nice, yeah. Breezes are great. All right, Katie, you'd like to go ahead?
Yeah. Hopefully you can hear me okay. There's a lot of air blowing around.
No, you're great. Yeah.
Yeah, I had a great time with my partner. That was like lovely. I also had a question. I'm trying to think how to articulate it. I've been practicing with naming my emotions when they come up and kind of investigating them, getting curious, like, okay, I feel angry. Am I really angry or am I sad and why? And then I started off by saying like, okay, I feel angry right now, or I feel sad. And then over the last week or so, I've been practicing with just saying, this is anger or this is sadness, which feels a little more disassociative to me. And I'm wondering kind of how those two work together, kind of how there's like the side of investigating the self and then also no self. And I don't know exactly how to ask the question, but it almost feels like not in conflict, but I just don't know how to like play with both of those. And I kind of like am oscillating between the two. So yeah, hopefully that makes sense.
But it does make sense. I think it does. Let's play with it a little bit and see how that lands for you. So on the one hand, that sense of, okay, noting your emotions, you know, just bringing more attention to that. It's a form of being mindful. Like, okay, I'm noticing, I know what's happening in my experience. And there's that, as you said, for the first bit of time you said, okay, I am feeling sad, I'm feeling angry. And then after a while you start to say, okay, just anger is present. You know, sadness is present. So both of those can be very skillful or also very unskillful, depending on how we're relating to it. So for example, the I am angry page or stage, or let's say mode anyway, can be really healthy if we're used to saying, you make me angry, for example. You know, those of us who have done therapy, that's often a first thing we start to say, acknowledge, okay, I'm angry, not that you made me angry. That's that releasing that projection. So it's really owning that experience. How is that feeling in my body? And then we can also explore that, okay, anger is just present. It's just flowing through, or sadness is just flowing through. If we kind of jump to that before really owning our own emotion, like I am angry, and just say there's anger present, we are kind of doing a little disassociation, perhaps a little bit of a spiritual bypassing. So it's really interesting paradox of going fully into the personal, really seeing it, and then from that depersonalization, we see the emptiness with it. If we think we're supposed to be empty and we try to kind of make ourselves into it, or kind of do a Dharma speak, you know, there's just, remember IMS does these skits, and they kind of made fun of that, how the Dharma students and practitioners sometimes have this, you know, instead of saying I'm angry, anger is present, anger is being felt, you know, instead of like I'm feeling angry. So you just kind of have to notice how you're taking up another stance, adopting a more subtle personality or subtle sense of self, you know, of the Dharma student who just allows emotion to be felt without really clinging to it. Or is it really that's how it's arising?
Yeah.
So I think, yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, I think I've been using it as a way to practice. Like I've been doing Kristen Neff's self-compassion workbook and trying to tap into common humanity. So I've been kind of using it for that of like, if I say this is anger, I can kind of tap into like that everyone gets angry and I'm not getting so like tangled up in the story around it.
Yes. Yeah. Beautiful. Yeah. I think then that's really helpful. Yes. I think it's that sense of stepping back a bit and just noticing, okay, what's the effects of what I'm doing? You know, is there's a sense of kind of releasing the personalization and the story around it, then that's helpful. So the emotion starts to become freer. It's almost like we start to notice that contraction, that quality of dukkha that's just really tied to that contraction of self. And we also notice when that contraction of self is not so there, it's not so present, or it's maybe it's loosening, and how that feels. And that's the release of that dukkha. And so I think that's something that we start to become more attuned to as our practice evolves and deepens and matures. We can start to see, you know, step back and notice, oh, I'm applying this strategy or this method, and what's the effect of it? Does it lead to that contraction? Sometimes very subtle, and sometimes it leads, or does it lead to that release? Also subtle. Does that make sense, Katie?
Yeah, it's kind of like you're like being mindful of your own mindfulness, or like you're kind of like investigating the investigation. Yeah,
that's right. Yes, yeah, that's that direction I think is helpful. You can be mindful of your own mindfulness or investigation of your own investigation. It's like that stepping back. There's this one image of like, if you know how you look in a mirror and you see the reflection of yourself. And if you have another mirror, you see the reflection of your reflection. You keep seeing reflections upon reflections. It's like that stepping back and seeing, okay, well, how am I relating? How am I forming? How am I creating the sense of me around this? How am I relating to it? And is it leading to kind of that hardening, or is it leading to that releasing?
It's really good. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Katie. All right. Who else is out there who has anything they'd like to share? Okay, Austin. Go ahead, Austin.
On my smartphone, it's a little challenging to navigate. One takeaway I had was asking the question was almost as powerful as responding to the question, because each time I kept putting the emphasis on different parts of the question, you know. How do emotions define you? And then there's a way of thinking about it where it's about the definition that takes shape in one's life based upon emotion. And then sometimes I would say, how does emotion define you? And same question, but depending on where I put the emphasis in the question, at least for me, it resonated differently. I might have completely different responses based on how it was framed. I don't know what that means exactly, but it taught me a little bit about language, I guess, and experience, and just how there's no right answer. And I found myself being a little frustrated about that when I was being asked by Lauren that question over and over. I just wanted to get the right answer and her to leave me alone. But thank you, Lauren, for not allowing that to happen. You're a great partner.
Great. Thank you for sharing that, Austin. I mean, you're talking about that, really the art of the question, and how you said that well, that emphasizing different elements of it bring forth a whole different quality to it. And that's something that these kind of dyads teach us, is how to do that for another person, but also to ourselves. You know, we have a question that, or maybe it's a phrase that really brings our heart alive. And you just sit with that and maybe emphasize different points and different aspects of that question. And then the frustration, you know, around being asked the same question and wanting to get to the right answer. I mean, that's also kind of that edge of investigation. It's not always a easy, smooth journey. Sometimes there's that resistance that comes up, and meeting that, you know, the patience of the person keep asking you the same question allows a different relationship to come up, you know, and just as you spoke about hearing the question, saying the question in different ways, you know, you can also hear it in different ways. And I always find these dyads reveal something I didn't know. They're surprising. And it is that kind of continuous questioning that we so often hard to sustain for ourselves. So thanks for sharing that, Austin. All right, anyone else like to share anything? Everybody's a little comatose from the heat. It's supposed to get cooler.
I guess
hey, Lauren.
I could say something. I was thinking about how wanting something pleasant and not wanting something unpleasant has a lot to do with all my emotions. And when I, one of the things you said was something about finding the sticking point in an emotion. And I was thinking that a lot of times a sticking point is kind of like, what do you want? And maybe a kind of a tenderness around that because, you know, you can't have everything you want and people get in your way and you miss those things that you wanted and you didn't get. And I just being, I guess, close to the feeling tone of, oh, this is pleasant, I really want this. Oh, this is not pleasant, I don't want this. And then the allowing part is kind of being kind to myself and these, and then not blaming it out and just maybe helping me accept my emotion. And then it can slip through, like you say, flow through. How do you get there? It's,
beautiful. That sense of, you know, so often we don't even acknowledge that there's that wanting or not wanting. You know, we're so focused on the emotion and kind of the projection outward and trying to fix things or make things a certain way. And coming back to just that, well, you know, I'm upset and I don't like it to be like this. I remember my daughter's here in the room and down in the basement, but I remember when she was like 3 years old driving around and she was really, you know, upset, she's having a lot of emotions going through her. And she was saying, I'm really upset and I don't, you know, I'm really upset and I don't want to be that way and I can't make it stop. And just that sense of perspective of just acknowledging that, okay, I am really upset and I don't like it. That allows that gateway into that tenderness, as you said. It's okay, let me just meet that. That of course you don't want to be that way. You don't want to have that difficult experience. And just somehow just acknowledging that that's here. That's here right now. You know, really what's, if you going back to the different origination, that's go closer to that feeling tone of unpleasantness or pleasantness, and how that generates this whole sense of movement. That's why the Buddha emphasized in the third foundation of mindfulness of Vedana, of noticing is this pleasant? I guess that was the second foundation of mindfulness. Is it pleasant or unpleasant or neutral? And that how that becomes this launching pad to this whole experience. So when emotion arises, you know, we can sometimes boil it down to, okay, there's this unpleasant experience or a pleasant experience that I don't want it to end. And how that sets up this whole relationship, this whole world around it. And how when we acknowledge that and maybe soften to that, turn with tenderness toward it, then there can be a way of allowing that just to flow through. Yeah, so thank you for sharing that, Lauren. We're having the dyad pairs. We had the first two people share and now the second two people. So that's a nice way to do it. Or anyone else like to share anything? I think you get a sense from, you know, people's sharing that, you know, emotions can be a very rich part of our practice. It can be a thing we struggle with, but at the same time, they can be really a gateway into how Dharma in daily life really comes alive. All right, so Kristen, go ahead.
So one of my questions is, when you're dealing with someone else who's having a really strong emotion at that time.
Yeah.
And how you want to connect with them. But let's say that you don't think it's a proper time to do it. But the person really just wants to go full steam ahead. Do you have any suggestions about that? Or
now you said you thought it's not a proper time or proper expression of the emotion. Is that what you said?
Yeah, it's just it's all encompassing to deal with maybe a person who's yelling or who is, you know, really acting out. And you know you need space, and you say, I need space. And the person doesn't deal well with that.
This is a person who you have more of a committed connection with, family member, something like that?
A teenager.
So it's
who I love, and I know I was one too, and everyone here has been a teenager. So
that's right.
We all know what those intense feelings can be. But one of the things that I struggle with is how to be a container without one either no boundaries or getting caught up in it myself when I need time to process.
Yes, it's a really nitty gritty question. And, you know, it's sometime next month we'll go into relationships and I might speak to that, you know, that element there. So being with someone else who's having a strong emotion, and, you know, when you talk about a parent child, you know, parent teenager relationship, it's really that it's interesting because there's that mirroring that's going on too, right? So just let's set aside the parent-child relationship for a second and just, you know, a loved one or a stranger or whoever it might be. It really, a lot of it has to do with your own comfort level with that emotion that they're feeling. So if someone's really angry and you're not very comfortable with your own anger, it's going to be hard to open to that. It's going to be hard, that sense of stability around it, because it's going to trigger you. Or maybe, you know, you have been harmed by anger in your past and that starts to come up. And so then having that sense of working with it, trying that boundaries, trying to have that space, you know, saying, you know, I just really understand that you're angry and I'm getting a little overwhelmed. Can I come back to you in a half an hour or 20 minutes or something like that? And actually, you know, with kids, it's interesting because that same thing comes up too, you know, and with kids, they know you. They know you probably better than you know yourself. And if you're kind of like doing the parent talk or the psychological talk, they're going to call you out on it. And it's going to inflame the situation, just like anybody would. They can sense when you're not being genuine. And so I think it's often trying to have that real clear observation of how things being received. You know, it's a give and take. It's a relationship. It's an ongoing dialogue. So they express their anger and you respond in some way. And you can respond in a way that flames up that anger, or maybe acknowledge, you know, they calm down a little bit, or maybe they, you know, feel this way or that way. And you can just see, okay, that way wasn't the right way to say it. And maybe that way was the right way to say it. And so it's really being that alive quality and realizing too that teenagers, part of their job is to separate from you. Part of their job is to push against you. And so that's part of it. You know, you could be the most skillful parent and still they need that. It's actually, they need that developmentally to push against. And so having that in perspective, and I think as a parent for myself is really knowing my own inner experience, how my own relationship to that feeling is and taking care of that. So I'm not trying to project that in them. And sometimes it is, you say, okay, we're just getting out of hand. Can we just take a break for 10 minutes, and they're probably happy to take a break from you too. And then, you know, come back and say, okay, you know, I try being more vulnerable, saying, you know, I just get scared. I get worried that this is going to happen, and tell me about how you're feeling. And so there's no clear ways, but the biggest one is just to know yourself, to really attend to your own experience and seeing how you speak from reactivity or responsiveness from that.
Actually, I just really felt what you just said. I mean, that just like hit me in the heart when you were like admitting your vulnerability. And I think that's something as a parent, I also, like, I always struggle. Like, I shouldn't let her know that I'm totally freaking out inside. I mean, she does know it to a certain extent, but that it's okay to just to sit with that feeling.
Yes. Yeah. I think the most thing we crave as human beings is that true connection. Mm-hmm. And if we're trying to have a posture or how we should be, we deny that. Mm-hmm. And even if so, okay, I don't know what to do. I'm as freaked out as you are. Then you're suddenly meeting as human beings. And then that's a place of connection there. So it's really a similar way we work with our own emotions. We get to practice that, and we have the great gift of feedback, you know, from our loved ones.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you, Kristen. Yeah, that's a very heartfelt question. And yes, I think we'll move into that more next month as we go into relationships. How they can be spiritual teachers. All right. So we've come to the end of our evening, and I want to thank everyone for your engagement in the dyad and also your questions and sharing. Just really helps to, you know, make the whole teachings alive, really brings it forth. It really has a sense of ownership. So thank you all for putting your voices out in the room, the virtual room.